on the wires.
Let me give you some data.
Go right ahead, Eric.
They're both Cat 5 and Cat 6 have similar characteristics in one respect. Also, in terms of their bandwidth, of course, is varies with distance. But typical Cat 5 cable, the standard is pretty much 100 megahertz worth of bandwidth in Cat 5. Okay, in Cat 6, you get 500 megahertz of bandwidth. I think 50 meters. And at 100 meters, it drops down to about 250 megahertz worth of bandwidth. The diameter of the wire difference between Cat 5 and Cat 6 is the Cat 6 cable is ever so slightly bigger. The typical characteristics of both cables is about 100 ohms. At 100 megahertz, the impedance, I think, is around 100 ohms, yeah. And the velocity factors are slightly different from one another. And the capacitance and the inductance of the cable was specified. I've got it on this piece of paper here. Where it's, the inductance is 525 nanohenries per meter, and the capacitance at 800 hertz is 52 pups. So, start from there. Also, the dielectric is a little bit different than Cat 6. I think it has a higher dielectric strength. Some of that is because of OSHA rules in terms of flammability. So RWK to again.
But the question wasn't answered. My previous question was you guys. Was that talking about one single player carrying on through one single twisted
repeater? Timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
About that. So that was my question. In TV industry, are four wires, two twisted pairs utilized or two or one only?
Let's see if Eric understood that question. Now go ahead, Eric.
Beyond the fact that it's timed out, I have a very hard time understanding what Wesley says. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention this. Typical IT application. Only two pairs are actually used for moving the data. They're both differential, of course.
Eric, is Cat 6 almost twice the price of Cat 5 because of higher priced materials, and it's not as much in demand, it's not the manufacturing as much quantity? So I'm making a guess that Cat 6 might be twice the price in dollars per foot.
No, they're not. I think it's the difference between like 24... 26 gauge, not that much. It's slightly more expensive, but not a heck of a lot. And more people are using Cat 6 because everybody's running gig E. Now, Cat 5's got a speed limitation, so either you run shorter distances or use Cat 6 because they don't make routers anymore that run at the slower speed. So, you know, when we started, it was like T-Base 10, which was 10 megabits per second. I went to T-Base 100. Which is pretty much Cat 5. Today everything is 1000 AC, which is, you know, a gigabit Ethernet. So Cat 6 really is the way people are going because it's using it more and more, the cost has come down. But it's not any more expensive than, say, Cat 5 was at the beginning of its life, so to speak. And more and more, like in this facility, all the cable I have to use is shielded, so that adds to the cost. K2RW, K2J.
$55 versus $68 in price date.
Those are nice prices. Is there a shielded version of Cat 5 and a shielded version of Cat 6, Eric?
You betcha.
What does that do to the increase in diameter and increase in cost?
Lots.
Oh, I think it's like 2 cents a foot or something like that. Actually, the Cat 6 stuff that they're making now, the diameter of it is ever so slightly bigger than the stuff without it. Although I have some Cat 6 that's really super shielded, and it's kind of thick and icky, and the turns radius is a little bit big. But it sure helps me out when there's lightning happening.
So you got a shielded for lightning protection, EMI protection. Not necessarily to get greater isolation between adjacent Cat 6 cables?
I mean, the nature of the whole CAT scheme is that you can lay all these tables on top of one another. They don't bother each other. So, you know, the shielding is sort of irrelevant. It's more external EMI issues that you want the shielding for.
Problem is that if you don't ground the shield, it may act as an antenna and create a whole lot of problems.
Yeah, if you've got a shield, I guess you got to ground it at least one end. Is that true, Eric?
Properly made systems have the shielding connected at both ends. Unfortunately, we'll actually put in the shielded stuff, bring it to the jack field, like I use jack field, and then I'll hook up the groundwater. That's one booboo. In another case, people will use unshielded jumpers and, you know, just break the integrity of the whole system. I mean, if you're going to run something shielded like that, you got to do it everywhere.
The RJ6 connector, I presume there is a shielded version of that. Is that true, Eric?
All the RJ45s I use have a metal shell around the plastic. And that hooks up to the ground wire in the CAT 6 or CAT 5 cable, and that makes a physical connection to the plastic you bring it in.
Most of the situation is used in our RJ45 doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, I suspect the majority of RJ45s are made out of plastic, but the high quality ones are metallic, and they provide the ground between the chassis and the grounded shield and the shield of the CAT 6 cable. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, it is. Actually, the whole connector is not metal. The connector is like a typical RJ45, except it has a shield around it, so to speak, except for where the pins are exposed.
By what means does the shield of the cable get connected to the outer shield of the RJ45?
Okay, well, first of all, there's a special crimper, let's call it. And different manufacturers, of course, have different crimpers. But the idea is this. If you thread it up the way you would normally thread up an RJ45, and then the thin little wire that is actually the shield wire, at the point where it inserts into the body of the jack, you take that and you wrap that around the tail of the shell that actually has a thing. It's sort of like a little piece of metal with a C on the end of it that gets folded over and crimped down on the outside jacket of the cable. And if you do a good job, you do two or three wraps of that thin wire, and it goes right through where the thing gets crimped together, and you get a pretty good connection.
It sounds like there is a messenger wire going down the shield, and you're grounding the messenger wire. The shield itself, I presume, is a foil. But by way of the messenger wire, that's how you're grounding the shield to the connector, Eric. Go ahead.
Correct.
I think I've got the picture. It was Joe, W-2-L-Y-Y, that way back, and now we're 15 minutes ago, he asked this exciting question. We got very far left and right of center, but he asked some darn interesting questions. Need any fills before we leave you, Joe, because we've got some other people we should be getting to pretty fast. W-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
No, you're right. It is like something like 2.408, not 2.45, as the other gentleman pointed out. I reworked out my calculator, and the signal generator does show that the different nodes are different frequency, but it corresponds to that number. I just asked the question just in simplicity to know what that was all about. It's also an interesting way of checking a service monitor or a deviation monitor to see if it's basically someone's in the...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay. We've done enough on that one tonight, Joe. We're going to move on. Bob, we're sorry we kept you waiting so long. WB2JOB. Hope we can put you to sleep. K2RAW, go ahead, Bob.
K2RAW, WB2JOB. I think, yeah, it was an interesting conversation. I was listening. I have a really simple question. I had purchased an Icon D80E 2-meter HT, which works great. My neighbor, seeing that radio, who was a fairly new ham, only he had his license about 6 months or so ago, he decided to get one himself, and he did. But I believe he bought the Chinese copy because he paid about or about a third of what I paid for my radio. In any case, the problem was this. When he got the radio, the battery was already attached to it, he told me, and it was completely dead. He put it in to charge it, and he's getting a clicking noise when the radio was charging. Now, once the radio was fully charged, he used it, the audio was great, he brought it over. I said, maybe it's the battery, so I took my battery, put it on his radio, did the exact same thing with the clicking noise, and took his battery and put it on my radio when it was perfectly good. So I'm just curious, what could be possibly causing this clicking noise when the radio is shut off? Any idea, Dick?
Now, part of what you said, Bob, sounds like the clicking noise is occurring while the battery is being charged. And another part of the conversation at the end, you said the clicking noise occurs with the radio turned off. Is it being charged or not? I don't know. So what are the periods you're hearing the clicking noise? And if the clicking noise is going on when the radio is not being charged, sitting on the table turned off, if that's what you're hearing, continuous clicking noise, my next question is, how long did that go on before it stopped? So give me some more fill on all of that, Bob. WB2JOB, T2RIW in the second half.
Yeah, okay, Dick. Yeah, I guess I didn't make myself clear enough. The clicking is happening when he's charging the radio, and after the radio is fully charged and it's in the off position, it still makes that clicking noise. When he turns the radio on, the clicking noise goes away, and the radio works fine. He's got some signal reports. I listened to him over here, and the audio is great, transmission is great. It's only when the radio is turned off, whether it's and when the battery is completely deleted, the clicking noise, of course, goes away. But it's only when the battery is attached to the radio and it's turned off.
Turned off and not being charged. Is that true? It's turned off, not being charged, and you hear continuous clicking noise until the battery gets dead. And how long does that take? Over to you, Bob.
I really haven't timed the amount of time that he's had the radio on before the battery actually goes down. But the clicking noise happens with the battery fully charged, attached to the radio, as long as the radio's not on. And it also happens when he puts it in for the charge position. So it's something with the radio itself. It's definitely not the battery. As I say, I put my battery into his radio, and it worked the same exact way. And his battery into mine, his battery worked fine. No clicking noise at all. So the clicking noise is happening only when the radio is turned off, whether it's fully charged or not. The clicking still happens whether it's fully charged or in the charge stand.
Yeah, many radios, a portion of the audio circuit is active even when the radio is turned off. And because it's a Class B audio amplifier, in theory, it's not drawing any current. So I got a bunch of guesses as to what's going on here. The radio itself sounds like there is a bit of an error. If turned off with a fully charged battery, it clicks. And, of course, it stops clicking when the battery is not fully charged because it's not getting enough voltage to do the clicking. So what you're calling clicking, it is possible that there was a burst of audio coming out of the loudspeaker of the radio. Is that possible from what you've seen and heard so far, Bob? WB2JLB, K2RIW.
No, Dick, what I've heard is an actual click, an actual clicking noise. Now, the strange thing about it, when he first got the radio, the clicking noise was fairly loud. You could stand on the other side of the room and actually hear it clicking in the office when the radio was turned off. Since then, the clicking noise has subsided quite a bit, so it's a very low clicking noise now. In fact, he tells me when he turns the radio onto a soft cushion facing down, he can't even hear it anymore, but of course it's still there. But it is definitely a clicking noise. It's not something that's coming from the speaker that's part of the audio.
I have a question, WHSCDL. Yeah, my first question before we go over to Andy is the clicking noise. Is it once per second, once per 10 seconds? How fast is the clicking noise? And is it a very cyclic clicking noise, Bob? Go ahead, Bob.
When I observed it, Dick, it was probably once every 1 or 2 seconds. And occasionally I've heard it actually do a double speech. But that was only once I heard that. But the majority of times that I've heard it, it's been a single click. And it probably runs between 1 and 2 seconds, or between clicks.
WA2CDL, wait for the beeps. Go right ahead, Andy. Andy. And have you... This is a strange one. You got it, Andy.
Yeah, the ID is going. I wanted to ask the question you asked, what's the repetition rate? But, if you turn the radio on, is there a battery saver function? Some of the radios have a battery saver. I know the Kenwood THF6 has that, and that's adjustable. And what it does is it draws less current on receive, so it actually turns the battery on and off at a certain repetition rate. So you won't drain the battery in the receive mode. It maintains a longer battery life. I don't know which radio this is, but if it has a battery saver, which most of the HDs have, see if it's on and turn it off completely, if it is on, and then check it. See if it still does it. I'm kind of curious if that's it.
Yeah, this is a brand X radio, Andy, you may have heard. It's a ICOM, equivalent ICOM V80E, but it's some other brand at one-third the price. And, so let's see what Bob should say on a question you just asked. WB2JOB, K2RIW, Greg Bob.
Yes, Andy, in fact, I actually did that. It does have the battery saver function on it. It's got all the functions that the original ICOM V80E, which I happen to have. I know it was a Chinese knockoff the minute he told me he paid a third of the price. Of course, he contacted the company to see about getting a refund, and they said they would give a refund, which in fact they did. He's well away ahead of the game because he was willing to return it, and they said, no, keep the radio, and they sent them a refund in any case. So actually, he got a free radio out of it, but I was just curious about this clicking. Yes, I did that. In fact, what I also did is another feature on there which you have to, if you go from a NiCad battery pack to replaceable AA batteries, you also have to set up a different mode. And I tried that because I do have a replaceable battery pack. I even tried that in the radio. It seems nothing I've done to it other than, sing to it and stop this thing from clicking on him. It's perfectly usable, and he's going to keep it, of course. He's got actually nothing at this point. But curiosity got me as to why this thing is doing that. In any case, back to you, Dick. K2RIW, WB2JOB. I still have the question.
Yeah, if that radio is in Andy's shop, and you could take the case off, it would be very interesting to find out where the clicking is coming from. To B2CDL, wait for the peeps, K2RIW, go ahead, Andy.
Alright, you don't have to keep telling me the ways of the beeps. I they're kind of obvious. I just didn't get the answer. Is the battery saver function on or off? And when you turn it off, if you did, does it go away? Does the problem go away? I'm not clarified on the answer.
He did answer that. He tried all those combinations, and the clicking does not go away. Bob, you want to confirm that?
Yeah, that's correct, Dick. I did turn off the battery functions. In fact, there are three different battery functions on that particular radio. The clone, they actually cloned all of that in there. So I did turn that off. And as I say, when you change from the replaceable, from the rechargeable battery pack, you have to go to a different setting for the disposable battery packs. I tried that with my disposable battery pack, and everything I did to it, the clicking still remains. What's unusual, though, is that the clicking was substantially louder when he first got the radio. It is substantially lower now. I would say it's maybe a third as loud as what it was when he first got it, and that's it for a full charge, so I'm not sure what's going on with that radio. It's got me baffled, Dick. Go ahead.
Let me just say something about this.
You got it, Eddie.
Yeah, these radios, as you know, have a memory function. You know, you turn them off, you turn them back on, and it holds the frequencies that you put into memory. And some of these microprocessor radios, you know, the processor itself never really turns off. and a lot of radios have this. It's called a keep alive voltage. Eric knows about this. It keeps the processor on all the time, and basically when you turn the power on, it tells the processor, wake up, you know, somebody's calling me. So the clock, the oscillator for the micro is always on in most cases. I'm not sure about this particular radio, but it could be you're getting some clock noise because of a poor ground connection somewhere. In other words, something to do with the microprocessor, because you say that it's varied, it's lessened in value. So maybe just by knocking the radio around a bit, it made a ground connection that wasn't there. You know, especially you know, things are not shielded properly. You got these oscillators going, causing that. I'm only saying that as a possibility. But the other thing I'm thinking is if you had a variable power supply and were able to connect it to the radio, and then started with zero voltage and turned up the voltage slowly, at what voltage does this occur? When does this start happening? That could also be a clue. So that's my suggestions right now and some thoughts. Nick?
Did you Eric recognized. A quick question to Andy first, though, and that is, if he did a microprocessor complete reset.
Repeater, timeout.
If he did a microprocessor complete reset, yes, he's going to lose all the frequencies he's programmed, and he's going to have to do that again. Do you think there's any chance that could correct what you believe is a microprocessor problem showing up here, Eric? I mean, Andy. Dimitri CDL, K2IW.
Yeah, it's possible, but I don't think so in this case. Of course, it doesn't hurt to try it. You got nothing to lose. Just do a full reset on it and see what happens. It's a possibility to answer the question, but I don't think so, though. I don't think that would have any effect. No, go ahead.
Yeah, Andy, you should be using earphones when you're listening to yourself. Eric, KE2EJ, you got it after the beeps.
K2IW, KE2EJ. Andy is pretty much right, except I want to make a correction to him. Terms of the keep alive circuit, many of them, and I've seen quite a few of them, but the oscillators actually do shut down when you do the wake up call, which actually causes a non matchable interrupt. It will then fire the oscillator up. Not in the earlier ones, but the later ones have these sleep modes where it puts the whole thing together, so it only draws microamps. You don't actually have to keep an oscillator going. But it is a Chinese radio, and I have seen where they put the wrong parts in, or parts don't actually get soldered down correctly, or I've noticed from some of them that there's infantile mortality. Because it sounds like to me, I mean, if I were checking this out, first thing I'd do is get another radio and see if it does the same thing. And right away you know whether there's an error in manufacturing or not. As far as the clicking goes, if I were going to try and analyze it, that kind of says to me power's going on and off. So, it could be there's a regulator on the battery that actually supplies the voltage to the keep alive circuit. There's some capacitors there. You know, you could have a little RC thing going. But my first guess would be get another one of the same radios and see if it does the same damn thing. And if it doesn't, you know, there's some error in manufacturing. I would probably put it to that faster than anything else. Resetting the microprocessor, sure, that's a cool thing to do, but chances are that's not going to solve it.
There's a little bit further mystery here, though, Eric. Bob is convinced the clicking noise is not coming out of the loudspeaker. There's ways of checking that by, you know, plugging in an external speaker that disconnects the internal loudspeaker.
Could be coming out of the electric microphone.
Okay, but my next question is, where could the click be coming out of? Out of the microphone? Not working backwards? I mean, click usually is an electromechanical device like relays, and these radios don't have anything like that. So,
electric microphones can run backwards. They can actually act like speakers. No, they're capacitive microphones, but you put a charge in it, you'll hear it.
Okay, he thinks the clicking noise is not coming out of the loudspeaker. That would suggest that the, even if the microphone is acting as a loudspeaker, that would be an acoustic source of noise. I think Bob would know the difference. If it's not coming out of the loudspeaker or the microphone, what else in there can be creating a click? It would have to be
radio.
Listen.
But, you know, today's radios don't use reed relays. They used diodes.
Okay, is there a reed relay in there? Eric, go ahead.
Seriously doubt it. When you've got something that small, I mean, they make them, but every radio that I've seen uses diode switching. They don't use relays.
So if it's not coming out of the loudspeaker or the microphone, and there's no other electromechanical device in there, we've got a real mystery. Let's see what Wes has got to say. Go ahead, Wes.
We started to talk about microphones, and I was thinking about microphone speakers and headsets. Why do they use 600 ohms headsets or speakers instead of, say, 50 ohm speakers standard in the TV industry?
Now, that's a standard that was set a long time ago. Bob, do you have a way of plugging in a speaker, an external speaker mic? In which case you would then be electronically disconnecting the speaker and mic on the radio itself. Now you've got this remote thing on a coil cord in your hand, and you can find out where the clicking is coming from. WB2JOB, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bob. By the way, after you do these experiments and come back to us, we're all kind of excited to see what you find out. You got it, Bob.
K2RIW, WB2JOB. Okay, number one, I reset it for him, put it back to, took all his frequencies out, and set them back in. It was still going to clicking when I shut it off after I do have a veritable power supply, so that was a good idea to slowly bring up the voltage. I also have, for my ICOM, I do have the, you know, speaker mic that floats into the side. Now, I haven't done that. That was a good point, which I'd actually have to do. I'm making the assumption I'm not hearing it from the speaker, but now I'm beginning to question myself, so I want to do exactly what you said by plugging in that the mic to disconnect, take a look at that. The other thing is, you know, it comes from China. Andy made a point, you know, banging around or whatnot. I have no idea, you know. I don't even think it came in a box. They had a bubble wrap, I think, with tape on it. He said, I asked where the box was. That was the other thing that threw me off right away. When I bought my ICOM, the batteries do not come attached to the radio. His came attached to the radio, completely dead. So there's a few things that you have mentioned to us. To me, those are the things I'm going to pass along. The microphone, veritable power supply, and possibly a problem with a bad solder connection. So good information, but as I say, I did reset it and had no difference on it.
Okay. When you've got some homework assignment there, Bob, when you come back next week, we'll be looking forward to hearing what you find out. That's an unusual radio. I've got a quick question for Eric and or Andy. Do any of the Baofeng radios have a standby search frequency function? Those are my words. In other words, is there a function I can command where once every second or two, it goes to another frequency to see if the frequency is occupied, then comes back to the frequency I'm using? So in other words, once every 2 seconds, you'll hear a bit of a click when it goes and monitors the other frequency. Do any of the Baofengs, like UV5R, or this other Baofeng I have, do any of them have that function? Andy first, the B2CDL, K2RIW.
That's probably called priority scan.
Either Andy or Eric, does either one know of that kind of a function being in any of the UV5R-like Baofengs?
The more expensive ones have a priority setting. The UV5R that I have, or even the yellow ones, they don't.
Okay, what are my UV5Rs? When it's operating on 450, once every 2 seconds or so, maybe 1 second, I hear a quick click continuously, as if it's monitoring another frequency. So I'm getting a click out of mine, but in my case, it's coming out of the loudspeaker. Anybody got any suggestions? It doesn't really bother me, but I'd love to know what's causing it and what menu I'd go to make it stop doing that.
How old is it?
3-4 years.
Probably something going wrong in it. As far as I know, the first generation, you're talking the first generation, does yours make full deviation, or do you get 2.5?
that really early version. That one I'm not all that familiar with, but I don't think they changed the software, and it could be wrong, because the later ones don't have it.
And you think it's a later failure. It did it from day one.
Is it the dual watch function, Dick?
Eric thinks I don't have that. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I got a bunch of the old ones. I've got a UV2 that has dual watch functions in it, so, and that's been around for a longer time than the UV5, so they all have that dual watch function. I think it's memory 28. I'm going by memory right now. See, I'm going by memory for memory. I'm not positive of that, but they all have that dual watch function.
Huh? Eric didn't think they had that dual watch function, and maybe memory 28. So I think you're telling me there's a way I can turn it off.
Yeah, if you go there, you go to that menu and do that, and then you go up to menu, it'll say on and off. Just hit the menu button again. It'll be allow you to turn it on or off, and then go exit, and it'll say, no, confirm. So, yeah, you can turn off that dual watch on all those UV5s, UV82s. They all have them, all of them, the UV2s, they all have it.
Okay, I'll have to look into that. Okay, the next person on our list was Angel. If he's still with us, we didn't put him to sleep. KD2VBG, I think it is. K2RIW, go ahead, Angel.
Look, I got a question, WHCDL, regarding what we just spoke about.
You got it, Andy.
Dick, you confused me. You just said that the audio is coming out of the microphone on his radio, not the speaker. Is that the case?
That was a possibility.
I didn't say that. Eric said that. So, Andy, talk to Eric.
I said that was a possibility. You know, that the electric microphones have a bias on them. The bias going on and off, you'll hear it as a click.
I think it's menu 7, not 28. My mistake.
Thank you. I'll look for menu 7. Any further questions, Andy?
No, but you said it, Dick. You said something about the microphone just now, and I thought it was the speaker. Just to clarify, it is the speaker that's making the noise, right?
Oh, no.
Bob thinks it's not the speaker making the noise. He thinks the noise is coming from the body of the radio itself. But we're going to have him plug in the speaker mic so that everything becomes remote. And now we can more easily find out where is the sound of the clicking coming from. Does that make more sense, Andy? Go ahead.
Oh, okay. All right. I wasn't sure because I was assuming it's coming from the speaker of the radio and not from the body of the radio. How could it come from the body? I don't understand that. All right. We'll wait till he gets his test. We'll see.
By the way, Andy, K-A-2-Y-H-Y, Steve, visited you today, and he came away highly impressed with your operation. He thinks you live in ham radio heaven. Go ahead, Andy.
Oh, okay. I didn't know you spoke to him. All right, that's good. I've been doing some business on the side.
But your garage and your basement apparently are extremely well equipped with test equipment, mechanical engineering equipment, lathe equipment, spare parts. He went away in awe with what you've got. And so he wants to inherit your house, Andy. Go ahead.
I told him I'll put him in my will when I move on. All right. All right, there's a story behind that, but I won't go into it. All right, thanks, Dick. You continue.
You'll need a big dumpster.
No, if it's high-quality stuff, you don't put it in a dumpster. Even if you don't have the room to keep it, you find some way of not putting it into a dumpster, Joe. One more call to Angel. KD2, ZBG, I think it is. Angel, are you there? K2RIW?
Dick, I think his call was KD2NWG. That was his call.
You're right. I can't read my own writing. November Whiskey Golf. Are you there, Angel? K2RIW?
And to use it, my battery is running out.
N2EO, you got the floor. Go ahead there, Rich.
Okay, Dick. I just want to say hello to everybody. I'm in Plainview Hospital. I should be coming home tomorrow.
Very fine. Good luck with all of that, Rich. We called you earlier, and you didn't come back, so maybe you were getting some service at that time, Rich. Go ahead.
Okay, Dick. Yes, a fine echo link is not very stable on the phone. Patty came here with a friend on Tuesday.
Okay, so you're coming home tomorrow. That's good. I think we're time to go over to the space report. WS2N, with space report number 260 of the series. K2LIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Oh, okay. Yes, it is 260. I wanted to talk about the ISS going over tonight, but of course that's not going to happen with the clouds. You're not going to be able to see that. But when you do, it's probably almost as bright as Venus. I've seen that quite a few times. As far as the space report goes, there haven't been that many flights lately to talk about. But there is a test going on out in California, a Dream Chaser vehicle that is being produced by SNC, Sierra Nevada Corporation, which will eventually be a cargo vehicle, bringing up the most cargo weight out of all the vehicles, up to 12,000 pounds. I'm not expecting a launch until probably late 2019. That will be going up on an Atlas V rocket, one of the bigger versions. Let me drop it. That rocket has five solid boosters attached to it. So it'll be the 5.5.2 version. Most of them are the last number is usually a one. Last number designates that they have just one engine on the second stage. This will be the first time Atlas uses two engines on the second stage. That's the plan anyway for now. Like I said, it's a heavy vehicle with a lot of capacity. Bring up the 12,000 pounds. That's over twice the amount that the Progress Russian cargo ship could bring up to the ISS. Now, the Dream Chaser is the one that is originally designed for a crew, but they got scaled back to just cargo and maybe a crew in the future. But right now, they've already got a contract with NASA for cargo. So they're testing it out in California. It's got wings on it, so it's about 25% the size of a shuttle, and it will come back and land just like the shuttle did. In fact, the first flights will come back and land on the shuttle runway in Florida. Drop it. Now they've gotten to the point where they could actually start testing this out in California. So they take baby steps first. They're taking it and they're towing it on the runway and then letting it go and then letting the guidance, navigation, and control is the GNC system operate on the spacecraft. There's nobody inside. Your computers, and the computers will go through its different paces and eventually stop it, put the brakes on, and they'll do this a number of times until they're happy with it, and then they'll start taking it up on a helicopter, leaving it attached in the beginning and eventually bringing it down. And then in the future, taking it and dropping it 2 miles up and having it land on a runway out in Edwards. And then, after some more tests, by the time 2019 rolls around, they'll be able to put it on top of that Atlas five rockets and left to the International Space Station. And the reason I'm bringing it up is the development of it. It's, they were coming along in 2013. They were planning on a crewed version, to actually put crew in it. And they went through all of these tests, and they got to the point where they put it onto the helicopter, bore 2 miles up and dropped it. And it landed, and the wheels, everything seemed to work good until the very end of the runway, the one wheel broke, and the whole craft actually rolled over. So they went back to the drawing board. They had a fighter jet wheels on it, and you know, it was just like a temporary thing. It wasn't going to be the orbital wheels, and whatever it was, it wasn't strong enough to hold the vehicle. So, but that's all been changed. Yeah. So they'll probably do it right this time. And this is going to be a cargo version. Like I said, not with people. It was originally designed to carry up to 7 people. And they still are planning on doing that. And even if NASA doesn't want it in the future, the European Space Agency would like to contract with them to eventually send people up in that spacecraft. But that's many, many years down the road. Let me drop it. Okay, on to another story anyway. The LISA Pathfinder mission we talked about here on the net a couple of years ago, and that was launched by the European Space Agency called LISA Pathfinder. It's a laser interferometer space antenna, and it was a test launch spacecraft. They wanted to put it into actually put it into the L1 launch 1.1 million miles out, 4 times the distance from the moon, but in the direction of the sun. And they left it there for a couple of years now. They ran tests. They had these two cubes inside, these two cubes that were floating perfectly. So they're only like picometers apart, and they had instruments to measure this. The idea is to keep it as steady as possible. The long-term goal was to see, you know, if this was doable, they would have another rocket go up, maybe three, in the early 2030s, actually called the LISA. This was the LISA Pathfinder, the laser interferometer space antenna. Would go up, you know, in 2030, let's say, and it would go like a million miles away from one another, three separate space vehicles launched by one rocket. And being a million miles apart from one another, they'd have lasers looking at each other, and they'd be able to measure themselves, measure their locations, you know, within this picometer distance. And the idea is to detect gravity waves. I know it's been done in on Earth with LIGO system, but now they want to do it in space. But to do it in space, they needed to see if they would be able to keep these cubes perfectly stable. And their expectations, they knew it was going to work right after they started, and they said it was 5 times more sensitive than what they predicted.
I've got a question on this one, Paul. If you're going to launch 3 spacecraft, each one is going to be in Lagrange 1. Lagrange 1 is a point roughly a million miles away from the Earth toward the sun, and there's only one Lagrange 1 point. And if there's 3 separate spacecraft, each a million miles apart, where are the other 2 spacecraft being placed? Over to you, Paul. K2LAW.
Well, they were going to have 3 spaced 1 million miles apart from one another. They said 2.5 kilometers. So I'm just saying probably 2.5 million kilometers. But yeah, a million miles apart from one another. And in this orbit around the sun, they probably won't use the Lagrange point 1. Maybe they'll have, from what I read, it looks like they're going to have a heliocentric orbit. So probably you know, maybe one leading around the Earth, one behind it. I haven't seen an exact location. The other one, you know, they're going to set it up in a triangular fashion. But, yeah, for this mission, it was Lagrange Point 1, and it stayed there a couple of years. And when I, you know, there's not one essential point. It actually orbits 500,000 miles. They call it a halo orbit. So if you were looking at it, you know, you would be looking, if you were to trace the orbit out, and like in front of a plate, it would travel that kind of an orbit. 500,000 mile diameter orbit there.
Okay, that halo orbit, is there one or three spacecraft there, Paul? Go ahead.
For this test, Lisa, Pathfinder mission, it was just the one. Where they're going to put the three, these three, they made it seem like they were going to put it in solar orbit, you know, probably one following the Earth, one behind the Earth, and then the other one at some other point. Some type of a setup like that. I would think it's going to be arranged like that, but I don't know. This is 13 years from now, they'll doing this. Maybe, well, you know, the way things go, maybe 31, 32, 1033. I mean, 2033, maybe. But the idea was to see if the system would work, if these cubes would stay exactly where they are. They were floating inside the spacecraft. In fact, NASA developed these nano thrusters, which would have, like, hardly any kind of thrust to compensate, just to compensate the solar wind that was coming at it. And whatever they had worked perfectly, they said. And this was launched on a Vega rocket built by Italy and launched by the European Space Agency down in South America in French Guiana. Back to you there.
I'm going to guess that this LISA Pathfinder gravity detector system, because there's going to be a large number of miles between the individual detectors, as opposed to LIGO, I think, has only 4 kilometers. So with a large number of miles, I presume it has greater sensitivity to gravity waves at a lower frequency. So therefore, two black holes in orbit with each other that are not about to crash together and getting to a real high frequency, but they're real far apart orbiting each other, maybe they'd be able to detect those. Is that sort of the thrust of this thing, Paul, WS2N, K2IW?
Yes, they said they would be able to record lower frequencies. Whatever the frequencies LIGO was doing, whatever that was, I don't know. I don't remember how many, what the frequencies were. But this is going to be definitely lower, just along the baseline. 100 pulses per second, some very low number. I don't remember. I can look it up, but it's extremely low frequency. Back to this.
Yeah, my understanding of this is that when the two objects orbiting each other that are about to crash together, just before they crash together, they get up to a real high rate, and you get that chirp of maybe a few kilohertz. But when they're far apart, you get a much lower frequency of the gravitational wave, and I suspect the gravitational wave magnitude is weaker. So you need the extra range to get the extra sensitivity for both the lower frequency and the lower amplitude of the gravitational wave. That's a guess on my part as to what's going on. And so if this thing is so successful on the first sample that they launched, kind of curious as to why there's going to be such a large number of years before the next launch takes place. WS2N, K2IW.
That's to do with money, and European Space Agency has money. I mean, you know, apparently these missions are very expensive. They're planning a flight to Jupiter. So, you know, I guess their budget is, you know, not only handle a certain amount of flights per year, like NASA, you know, the next telescope after the James Webb Space Telescope, have 4 or 5 that scientists would love to have, the astronomers, and then out of the 4 or 5, you have to pick one. And that'll be, you know, 10 years from now by the time they launch that. So there's going to be decisions on which one to launch. But the European Space Agency has this thing going. Well, we'll be part of it because of the thrusters that they invented, that NASA put on on their spacecraft. So that means by doing that, we'll get, you know, we'll get science that comes out of it as well. And it's so many years away. Let me drop it. That, you know, these are like, I don't know, 6,000 kilogram spacecraft. There'll be like three of them. And they're all going to be launched on one rocket. And they would normally think, well, it's going to go up on the Ariane 5 rocket. That's the Ariane, you know, the European Space Agency's heavy lift rocket. But by that time, that thing's going to be retired. So they've already got an appointment launch on an Ariane 6, which is presently being developed by European Space Agency. Again, it costs billions of dollars to develop these new rockets, so, you know, there's only so much money to go around. So, yeah, I'm sure if the money was there, they'd probably say, you know, let's start building it now. But it's been approved, let me put it that way. They have, you know, some of these things that they come out with, they talk about buying a sky project, never actually gets approved. This thing is actually approved back to 2013.
I wonder if I should take a little bit of an interruption here and describe what's going on at Brookhaven Laboratory. I promised that earlier and I forgot. So with your permission, Paul, I'll take a few minutes off and tell you people what's going on at Brookhaven. Go ahead.
Okay. I was supposed to go last week, but I didn't make it. My daughter did. I didn't get a report on it yet. Back to you, Dick.
Brookhaven Laboratory out in Upton, New York, near Exit 68, near William Floyd, on the William Floyd Parkway. Once every summer for the last few years, they hold an event they call Summer Sundays. It really is a kind of open house to the public. And this year, it goes from July 16th to August 6th, each Sunday. So July 16th was last Sunday, July 23rd was this Sunday, today. The next one is next Sunday, July 3rd, and then the one after that is going to be August 6th. So you've got two more Sundays to go. Today's event was specializing in the what they call the CFN, Center for Functional Nanomaterials. So I went to that one today, and you had lots of displays and lectures and whatever, and what they're doing with nanometer-sized materials, graphene and stuff like that. Pretty nice display. As I said, the price is right. And if you go to their website, you'll get a lot more specific information. You could Google the word Summer Sunday or DNL Summer Sunday. I could give you the actual website, but it's a pretty long one. By way of Google, you'll find it pretty fast with just going to DNL itself and looking for Summer Sunday. Let me drop it. So today's series of lectures, which began at 10 o'clock in the morning and went till roughly 4 in the afternoon continuously, was on the function of nanomaterial research. Next Sunday is going to be on the bright light dazzling discoveries, in other words, the National Synchrotron Light Source. They're going to give you lots of information and displays and lectures on that subject next Sunday, July 30th. Starting at 10 o'clock in the morning. And then August 3rd, August 6th, Sunday, August 6th, the main subject is going to be Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider. They're going to give you lots of information about that particular facility. It's pretty well run. Each of these displays, it starts off with the main lecture hall. They give you about a 30-minute lecture. They then put you on the buses, take you to the actual site, you see the hardware, you talk to the people, you look at all of the murals that they put up, telling you what's going on, giving you pictures and words and whatever. Let me drop the mic. My main suggestion before going there is try to get a map of the Brookhaven National Laboratory facility. as you pass the main guard booth, they say just follow the signs. Well, those signs are rather poorly marked, and it's not easy to get to where you're going. So to have a map ahead of time would give you an advantage, because they live there, and they know what to look for, and all of those roads are burned into their head, and so to them it's easy to navigate. To the rest of us in the rest of the world, their roads are a little bit spooky, and the signs are not as clear as I'd like them to be. Maybe it's my eyesight, but I had a little bit of trouble finding the parking lot of the facility where you start off with the first lecture and the bus ride. Let me drop. But B&L does do some very nice work, and they got some very nice people. It is the what would you say now? The newly hired people who are doing most of the display function descriptions. It is the real scientists themselves that give the lecture in the lecture hall. So my slight disappointment was that when I went to Port Jefferson High School, once per year they would invite the students of Port Jefferson over to Brookhaven Lab. In those days, they would bring you into the real laboratory with the real scientists during a work day week. Saw them using the equipment and got a chance to talk to the real people. The slight disappointment I had is that in this case, you're talking to people who are joining the laboratory. I called them adjuncts. That's not the right word, but you know what I mean. People who are being introduced to the laboratory are now bringing you up to speed as to what they're doing. The actual scientists themselves, not all of them come in on Sunday. But still, the place is right. The place is doing some exciting work. They got some very good hardware and exciting projects. So do consider that next Sunday, July 30th, and the Sunday after that, August 6th. Anybody have any questions on Summer Sunday at Brookhaven Laboratory? Give me your call letters right now. K2LAW in the TechNet. Okay, nothing further. Please continue, Paul. WS2N with the next half of the space report, number 260, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Oh, one comment about the Brookhaven Lab. When I went out there, I mean, it's like a massive place. I think they even had their own gas station at the time when I worked over there. But you talk about the RIC program, the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider. Had us over there doing some heating and air conditioning to one of these vector buildings. They called it the Atlas. The Phoenix, the Atlas, I think it was in the Atlas one. But nevertheless, that facility is 1.5 miles in diameter. So, you know, there's roads that go all around that thing. And then those roads go to other places. So, yeah, you can get yourself fouled up with goods. The first time I went out there, I went with somebody that had worked there before, so it was no problem. And then the previous time before that, there was something called Isabel. So I worked in Isabel. The pipe work that had to be done. But then what happened was Isabel was canceled. That's it. We're not going to have this. Isabel was an acronym for it. Now I forgot what that was for, but that was going to be one of these colliding things. But that was done away with. And then many years later, they came out with the RIP program, the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider, with this gold proton. Well, there was these two pipes. I remember seeing these two pipes. And it went around this whole 2.5 mile track. I think I remember the guy saying they go around the track 10,000 times per second, you know, to get up to speed. These two gold things crash into one another. I wonder if they're going to have a class or instructions about the RIC program, Dick, back to you.
I think the answer is yes. August 6th. The main topic of discussion is relativistic heavy ion converter, collider. That's the main topic of discussion. There will be others, but that's the main topic of discussion on August 6th, whereas August 30 is going to be on the National Synchrotron Light Source. Over to you, Paul.
Okay, I can go to either one. The light source facility, I think that's a round track now, too.